am getting back to the basics, as Leanne introduced us to, talking about clothing, which I think, like food, is one of these basic necessities of life that in some ways we often kind of zoom right by in our studies of the past. And but it's one that has caught my attention lately. So I guess I'll first start with Leanne's question about why doing this. And I will admit, this sort of archive, the first question you don't ask when you see it is, well, what were they wearing? And that's just not, you know, the obvious question. This is a textual archive. It's full of words. So what am I doing thinking about material objects? Well, it's in some ways, like I'm sure with a lot of you, it's just simply where my curiosity was at the point this spring when the deadline I set. I had to turn in something. I was just finishing a book manuscript about wartime emancipation. And in that book, I have a chapter about clothing. And it's part of my larger interest in that book of thinking about the overwhelming task of physical survival in this war. And for me, when I'm looking at emancipation and specifically the journeys of people in and out of these refugee camps or contraband camps, it becomes really elemental to the process of emancipation, simply feeding oneself, clothing oneself, sheltering oneself. And so I was thinking a lot about that already, and I'm sort of a self-taught material culture analyst. I'm not even sure I'm yet taught. I'm just teaching in process right now. So that's where my curiosity was, and so I wondered, well, what can these texts, what can these documents tell us about this very basic essential of survival? And it turns out quite a bit. And because, of course, you know, objects like clothing, they exist in their physical form, but they also exist in the consciousness, in the thoughts, and in the writings of people. And it turns out that these people had a lot to say about them. And I think this is something that, this gets back to a question I think even Ed was asking last night about digital archives. This is the sort of topic that needed a digital archive to examine because, like food, and, I mean, you already made this point, clothing is very much embedded in everything. And so it's just kind of woven in, so to speak, to all these sorts of cases and petitions that in hard copy, I never would have gone to the KDLA or wherever the originals are and looked there to learn about clothing. But now can really dig into kind of these sort of basic essentials of daily life and can see them in a way that maybe we couldn't before. So like 24 hours later, I'm answering your question. So what sort of burbles up from doing similar keyword searches? Cloth was probably number one. And in fact, I'm still searching. So this is definitely a work in progress. But what comes up is that clothing was more and more to these Kentuckians than simply being this kind of timeless means of covering up and protecting their bodies. It was a very valuable possession, clearly, one that was fought over, one that was hidden, stockpiled, manipulated, taken off, destroyed, and what really comes up in these cases, stolen. Clothing theft really popped up a lot more than I had expected. And I think a lot of this had to do with the fact that clothing was a valuable possession that would be seen by other people. Seen by one's enemies, seen by one's friends. It's a visible expression of who an individual was or who they wanted to be or not to be. And whereas one case that I, or one example that I start the paper off with, the petitioner described clothing as a distinguishing mark of social and political identity. And he was actually very upset when somebody didn't have the right distinguishing mark for who he really was. Now this is, of course, really just amplifying in some ways what we already know about clothing. Clothing had always, well before the Civil War, demarcated and reinforced the boundaries of racial identity, class, gender, and so forth. But I think it's interesting to think about in a time of war how it also played no small role in differentiating Confederates from Unionists, soldiers from civilians, slave and free, and more. And so all sorts of cases like this or that reveal this came up. I think pretty common were ones that probably won't be too surprising, the guerrillas. The guerrilla forces stealing clothing from stores, from aid societies, from women's drawers, and then turning around and dressing like women, dressing like civilians, dressing like Union soldiers, so they can then slip into a town undetected and torment those who live there. So you see the way clothing is really integral to the deception that they were engaged in. Similar thing with the deserters, who trying to abandon their position and status as a soldier, literally shed their clothing and try to adopt citizens' clothes to blend in and be believed as civilians again. The case of the master who, a man, now I can't remember his name, but he went nearly ballistic when the woman he enslaved but hired out to somebody else had begun stockpiling clothing in a trunk. And you know, this sort of drove him, it seems, that to wonder what was she going to do with it. Was she going to clothe herself to look freer and to pass as free? Clothing seemed to kind of represent something emancipatory to him. And then, of course, this is a state where legal freedom during the war only came from military service. And so uniforms were like the new free papers in a place like Kentucky. So in a place like this, and actually now I want to temper some of what I was thinking about, sort of the uniquely Kentuckiness of this based on what we were talking about this morning, but in a place marked by the ambiguity of people who are constantly shifting their alliances and their loyalties and some of the ways we talked about already, a place where people are trying on new identities as quickly as they're abandoning them, clothing offered clearly a kind of distinguishing mark, to quote that example again, that could sort people out and determine how one was perceived, and therefore how one was treated, and therefore whether one survived the war at all. So it's no wonder that there's so much contestation over clothing inside and embedded in these records. So as I said, I'm still working through this and working through these ideas, but I thought I would end with just a couple thoughts on why I think this is worthwhile. In other words, what are my sort of goals with this essay, this article? And one is what I alluded to before, pushing forward my engagement with material culture, but also I think historians' engagement with material culture, particularly at the war, and some of you may have gotten a copy of Civil War History this month, great issue on Civil War material culture. So kind of joining up with them, and I think that what all of this work is doing is, you know, maybe not helping us rethink the why questions of the war, like why the war came, but some of the how, and how it was lived, how it was experienced. I think there's a lot to be gained by thinking about material culture. So that's one thing. Second, to talk about this aspect of the material lives of Civil War Americans is to take more seriously, I think, the ways that they employ their senses to comprehend the world around them. So here I'm influenced by people like Mark Smith's book, Smell of Battle, Taste of Siege. Clearly, to think about clothing is to think about what Civil War Americans were seeing in one another and how they were literally employing their sense of sight to comprehend one another and ultimately figure out how to treat one another. You know, it's an old cliche, seeing is believing, but in fact that it does seem through these records to come out to be what many Civil War Americans went on. It was a time of emergency, they had little else to go on. So the sense of sight was really crucial and important. So I'll leave it there, but my aunt, very much a work in progress, and welcome all feedback and comments and questions.